In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. Today we've got a very special program for you. I'll be joined by Bill Wyman, bass player in the Rolling Stones for some 30-plus years. Since departing in 1993, he's also explored interests in archaeology, photography, and writing. But he's never stopped playing music. For 20-plus years, he led the Rhythm Kings, and since 1972, he's pursued a solo career. His latest solo full-length, Drive My Car, features our recent coolest song in the world, Thunder on the Mountain. We'll listen to a portion of that now, and afterwards, Bill will join me for our coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
Thunder on the mountain, fires on the moon, the rockers in the alley, the sun rises soon. Today's the day, gonna grab my bass and blow.
Mighty Manfred here with you in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, and it's the big day for our coolest conversations because joining us is singer, songwriter, musician Bill Wyman, best known for playing bass in the Rolling Stones for over 30 years and leading his Bill Wyman's Rhythm Kings and pursuing a solo career. In fact, his latest solo album is Drive My Car, and it's home to our coolest song in the world this week, Thunder on the Mountain. Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm good. Very good, actually.
Well, I'm very honored to be speaking with you today.
All right. I'll believe it.
Yeah. Okay, latest solo album, Drive My Car, came out last summer in August. I believe it's your ninth solo release. It's been 9 years since the previous one, Back to Basics. What was the impetus to do a new album?
Well, I do so many projects. You see, I write books, I do archaeology, I do charity work, I do all kinds of stuff, so, and photo exhibitions and things. So it's just a matter of when I've got time or when I'm in the mood to get into music again. And so it did take a while. But in between, I wrote like four books. So I'm always working and productive. It's not like I sit on my backside and just do nothing. I'm always working, I'm always doing projects. And I've obviously got a family. And so they come and go, the music. I'm working on the next solo album at the moment, actually, down in my basement, putting some basic songs together, which are sounding good. So, and I've got four more books I'm working on at the same time, you see, so...
No, well, what are the books that you're working on right now?
There's a mystery book, of a historical one. It's not like fiction. It's factual, from the 1100s. So that's very interesting. And then I've just finished a book on the history of my manor house in Suffolk, which goes back to 1480. It's about 300 years before America. I've lived there for over 50 years now. So I've done a complete history on that house, and I've got a few other things as well, so which are a bit secret, so I'm not going to talk about those.
Oh, well, fair enough. Well, the liner notes I was handed mentioned that you have, for the album, for Drive My Car, mentioned you have Terry Taylor on guitar, Paul Beavis on the drums, and Talking about Terry for a moment, he's played with you in the Rhythm Kings, but I believe you produced his band The End back in the 1960s. Is that when you guys first met?
Yeah, and Tucky Buzzard, he was in as well.
And Tucky Buzzard, okay.
It's in the 70s, Tucky Buzzard, they toured America quite a lot. And he's working with me actually downstairs. He's just gone shopping for me actually while I'm doing this. Yeah, but we also had Andy Fairweather Lowe on guitars. We had Robbie McIntosh, who's a great guitar player. So there was just that, it was just the four of us, you know, bass, drums, guitars. That was basically no keyboards, no horns, no backing vocals, or anything like that. I kept it really, really basic.
And what is it about Terry's guitar playing that you enjoy? Because you guys have been working together for quite a while now.
Well, he can play anything. He can play from blues to soul to gospel to rock, folk, and he can play classical as well. He's learned classical guitar playing because he worked a lot in Spain, and so he learned all that as well. So he's very, very talented. He can do all kinds of music, so I use him as my right-hand man when I do my first basic music for the songs, and then I overdub it, obviously, and add to it in the studio afterwards. That's the way I do it.
Well, the foundation of any rock band, you know, is the rhythm section. Tell me about the drummer, Paul Beavis.
Well, he's Andy Fairweather's drummer, who used to be in Amen Corner in the 60s. And he's got his own band. He's worked with Eric Clapton for years and years and years. And is a great friend, actually. And Paul is a wonderful drummer. And, you know, in your bass player, you either can or can't work with a drummer. You know, like with Charlie, it was amazing. And then Graham Broad with Rhythm Kings was amazing. Henry Spinetti, I use sometimes, he was rather good. But Paul Beavis sits really, really well with me on bass. We complement each other very, very nicely. So I'm going to be using him again on the next album, actually.
Well, the songs on the album, they run a gamut from like 50s style rock and roll, rockabilly, to blues, country blues sounds. Did you have set out with that as kind of a vision of the album?
Yeah, I wanted to make it very, very much in the style, basically, of J.J. Cale. Give or take a few tracks, you know, but basically keep it. And that's why I kept it simple, drums, bass, guitars, as JJ does. And so, and my voice suits that kind of style also, because I'm not a young man anymore and I can't do the highs anymore. So I have to, you know, I'm pretty low in my vocal. So I do that style much better than anything else.
Well, our coolest song of the world of the week is your version of Bob Dylan's Thunder on the Mountain. For Dylan, it's on his 2006 album, Modern Times. Well, what is it about the tune that spoke to you and said, you know, you should cover it?
I just thought it was interesting. You know, I wanted to do a few other people's songs. Previously, I'd always done all my songs on the albums. But I wanted to do a few songs that I liked that done by other people. So I did the J.J. Cale song, I did the Taj Mahal song, the Dylan song, and so on. And I kind of liked the way they came out, and I could do them in my style, take them away a bit from where they originally were and do them in my style, a bit like J.J. And it worked really nicely, and so I was very happy with it. And I really liked the way Thunder in the Mountain came out. It's different to Bob's, but I mean, I obviously use a lot of Bob's basic ideas there. You know, he was a great friend that I knew in the 60s, and I've always had a very fond love for him, and he's always been very, very nice to me.
So your version of Thunder in the Mountain's got this great sort of drive going along, a rockabilly vibe to an even. How does the Wanda Jackson version play into your arrangement?
Well, that was the other version that I'd heard, and it was a bit more rock and roll, a bit more gutsy kind of. Bob's was nice and melodic, and the way he always does them, laid back. So I merged the two, actually, and I borrowed the riff she did which I thought fitted very nicely, and that worked very well on the track as well. So
I was listening back to her version. It's like a horn thing that they're doing.
Yeah, it's a very complicated intro, isn't it? You know, which I didn't want to know about.
But that what's cool is that they have that sort of horn bit that you guys transpose onto the guitar. It's just a really cool guitar lick, and I was surprised that that is how the that guitar lick began, was like a horn part. I wouldn't have thought that.
Yeah, I know, but it fits very nicely, doesn't it? And it just gives it that little bit extra, which Bob didn't have on his original version, obviously. But I thought it was nice to add that.
Well, you mentioned befriending Bob back in the 60s. I want to speak some more about the album, but I read that you and like Brian Jones used to room a lot together as the band was gaining notoriety back then, and you were both good friends with Dylan around 64, 65.
Yeah, and John Hammond and all the guys in Greenleaf Village at the time. We hung out and we were very friendly with Bob. He was very, very nice in those days. He loved the Rolling Stones. He always had very, very complimentary things he said about us. He would join and meet up with us whenever we came on tour. And so it was very nice to be a distant friend, really, not a close friend, but a distant friend. And Bob always said nice things about me, which I was very, very embarrassed about, actually. But he was always very complimentary about my playing and things like that. So it used to embarrass me a bit, but thank you, Bob.
Do you recall how you guys met?
He came to the hotel, I think, in New York when we were there, and we met up. In fact, he was around when you had the big electricity cut in 66, was it, 65.
So you guys met that night. Did you ever have the opportunity to play with him? Not on official recording, but just to play, jam at all? Or
No, nothing. Brian did. Brian jammed with him on a few occasions. But I played with John Hammond on his first album, and that's where I first became friends with Bob, because I met him afterwards.
Oh.
John took me on his motorbike, and we went to dinner. Bob was there with Robbie Robertson and a few other guys. And so I was able to meet him. And then me and Brian would meet up with Bob, you know, when he used to come to the hotel and hang out with us and all that.
Well, thinking back about the album on Drive My Car, you mentioned a couple of moments ago about liking wanting to do some other artist's tune for it. You do a couple of songs by this Dutch guitarist, Hans Thiesink. And this is so Storm Warning and Wings.
Yeah, nice, aren't they? Nice songs.
Yes.
And they fitted with the whole style of the album, you see. That's why I like doing them. And he does really, really nice blues stuff. I've been listening to his stuff for years. And in fact, I met him when I did a book signing in Austria. He came and I signed his book. And there's a photo of us together. It's when I first met him. And then I started to collect his records. And he does some really, really nice bluesy stuff, you know. So I really enjoy his stuff. So I wanted to do a couple of things. As I loved, other people, Taj Mahal. That track we did of Taj Mahal, yeah, he just played it on a banjo. We just adapted it and put it into, you know, Terry Taylor put beautiful guitar on the front of it and all that. And it became like a little bluesy thing. So that was nice. And, you know, it's nice to do other people's songs sometimes where they really grab you. John Prine was a great friend of mine. You know, I knew him very well. He used to come and see the Rhythm Kings. I used to go and see him live when he used to tour.
And right, you cover his Ain't Hurt Nobody song on the album.
Yeah, but the Rhythm Kings did a few of his songs previously. And so I did that one because I really liked that track, and that kind of fitted in the image of the album as well. It was a matter of making everything not change too much, you know, sort of everything sort of flowed in the same kind of mood and same kind of feel, even though the songs were completely different.
Right.
And I was so pleased with the results because a lot of people complimented me on that. I mean, the first track I ever played to Bob Geldof, I think it was, or Mark Knopfler or someone, they said, you sound like J.J. Cale. And Andy Fairweather started to call me J.J. Wyman, you know. So I realized that I was on the right track because they were seeing the contact that I was trying to make.
Well, I looked up the guy who wrote Two-Tone Car, this Chucky Wise.
Oh, yeah, that.
And I found out he was like a buddy of Tom Waits. How did you come to that song?
I just had it in my collection. And I had huge problems with the lyrics because I could never find the publisher. I searched everywhere for the publisher and the lyrics. And I had to guess some of them because they're mumbled on the original. And I had to kind of guess them and sort of replace a few with ideas that I had that I thought might suit. But I wanted to do that because it was an interesting track. It was a fun track. And it was about cars again. And I did my song, Drive My Car, which was the title track. So that kind of fitted too.
Well, you close the album with Fool's Gold by Lloyd Jones.
Oh, yeah.
So he's like a Portland blues guy, maybe?
I don't know where he came from. It's again, it was just something in my collection that I pulled out. And, I thought that might fit, you know, that might be worth doing. And once again, it's got an amusing lyric in it, you know. So
when you were putting together songs for that you might want to do for the album, did you just go through your collection or think about songs that, I mean, you're just pulling stuff out?
No, I just, when I'm listening to music on iTunes or anything, or anybody gives me a CD or anything, and there's something I think I could possibly work on or get ideas from, I'll pull it out and put it, and I'll collect them on the side on my computer, you know, in a folder. And then when it comes to starting to put music together, I go through them and I'll probably cut 16, 18, 20 tracks, you know, and choose the ones that fit each other the best, you know, and don't stand out in the wrongly. And so then I reduce it down and then we finish up with the best dozen or whatever, and a couple of bonus ones or whatever. I think that's the way I do it. And I think it's the easiest way. I mean, I'm working on songs now. I've got over 20 downstairs we're working on, but we'll end up with the best 12 that match, you know, match each other.
So another favorite of mine on the album is one where I think Terry is listed along with you as co-writer, Rough Cut Diamond.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that one dates back to your Rhythm King days?
Yeah, that came out on the double CD. I didn't think it got the attention that it deserved, and so I thought I'd redo that because I like it. You know, I'm a rough cut diamond, and everybody says diamonds are a girl's best friend. It seemed to be a nice thing to say because I am a bit of a rough cut diamond, actually. I'm not Mr. Pure, you know, and so there we are. There was another one that fitted in, and it was a good one to do.
Rolling Stones, they came out with a new album a year ago this past October, Hackney Diamonds. And you play on the track Live by the Sword. I think they let Sir Elton play on that as well. How did your involvement on the song come together?
I just got a call from Mick and from the producer, Andrew Watt. And they just called up and said, we got this track that's got Charlie on drums. Charlie's now passed. It'd be nice if you could be on it and you and Charlie could be together again on this track. So I said, yeah, okay, I'll do it. But of course, the media said that I flew to Los Angeles and worked on the band. I didn't at all. I did it up. They sent me the tapes and I did it up in London. And I did the track. It was a bit busy for me. I like things a bit more simple with a bit more air in them, a bit more spaces. But I did what I could on it, and they were very, very happy. They complimented me very much on what I'd done on it. And then I said, is there anything else you want me to do while I'm here? And so I did another track. I don't know the title of it, actually. But I played on another track, and I said, what's happening with that? And they said, we're going to save that for the next album. So I don't know whether I'm on the next album. And then when I finished, Elton came in to do his overdub, so we had a chat as well.
Oh, good.
Because I've known Elton for years, obviously, and been socialising and all that. And so it was nice to say hello to him because I hadn't seen him for a few years.
And this other track that you were playing, that you played bass on, was that also something that Charlie was playing the drums on?
No, it was just another track. It was more bluesy track, more relaxed, more open. And I just put in what I thought was a pretty decent bass on it because I didn't have bass on it. And so I don't know what's happened to it. I don't even know the title of it.
But that one had the more of the space that, yeah.
Yeah, it was more open, the kind of things I prefer. I don't like full-on stuff, you know. I can play on them, obviously, because some Stones tracks are like that, which I played. But generally, I like more air and space in a song, you know. I like emptiness. I like holes when I play bass. I don't fill it up. I leave holes. And I like those, you know. Growing up, listening to Booker T and the MGs, you know, and then Duck Down being my favorite bass player, who was my best friend as well. They played in that kind of way where there's lots of space, lots of open in it, you know, relaxed. And that's the kind of music I like. And that's the kind of music I played with the Rhythm Kings for 20 years. And that's more like I do as a solo artist as well. I don't like full-on stuff, you know. I don't like it anymore. Too old for that. The older you get, the less you like volume. You know, you don't like things noisy anymore. There's three things when you get old. Volume, height. You don't like heights anymore. And you don't like speed. It's weird. They're the three things that you don't feel comfortable with them. You'll find out that when you get older, I assure you.
Well, I was thinking speed, that relates back to drive my car.
Yeah, I said don't drive fast, didn't I? Drive my car, but don't drive fast. See, it's the same thing.
We're going to get to that too, but let me ask one more thing about the Live for the Sword. So you go in there and you're playing to Charlie's track. Was that odd?
Not at all, you know. But it was very, very busy. So it was very difficult for me to find room in it to play notes, actually. So, but as I say, Mick called me from France and complimented me and said he absolutely loved what I did and that. So it was a pleasure to do it. And it was lovely to do it with Charlie, who was my best friend.
Well, so, I mean, you must be on fairly good terms with those guys still, though.
We're family, you know. We still, you know, even though I haven't been in the band for 30 odd years, I was in the band for the first 30 years. And all our, you know, our children know each other's children and things, you know. When Mick's children and Mick and Jerry's children have birthdays or anything, some of my children go and have and celebrate with them. And, it's very family. It sounds a bit corny, but it is. And it can't be anything else when you've been together for 30 years or more, you know. It stays family. It's the old adage, isn't it? It's the old adage. I like Auntie Ethel and Uncle Fred. I love to meet them, but I don't want to see them every day of the year. It's a bit like that, you know. I love the boys. I've got a different life now. But we stay friends and I stay close and we keep in touch.
Brian Jones, we were speaking of him briefly, such an enigma in so many ways, so full of contradictions. I really like in, again, the autobiography of Stone Alone, how you stress his importance in forming and running the band early on.
Creating the band,
because nowadays, folks I meet that are younger than myself, to them, you know, so weirdly, the Stones really exist from pretty much, you know, beginning of the 70s, it's sort of Mick Taylor-ish forward. And they don't seem to have as much an appreciation of or that knowledgeable, or they're not really listening to the sort of Brian Jones era of the band.
Yeah, but you can hear him on every one of those 60s hits, you know. That's the point. He made some of those songs into classics with Dulcimer or Glockenspiel or Marimbas on Under My Thumb, boom, blim, 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 blim. He did all those kind of things using sitar on Paint It Black and so on and so on. But obviously he lost his ownership of the band, his being the leader, very shortly because Mick was the front man and Mick and Keith started writing the songs. But they took the Stones on to the way they were, you know. But Brian set it up, basically. He laid the foundations. He put the band together. He gave the band the name, the Rolling Stones. He signed the contracts, the management contracts. He signed the recording contracts. He was the leader, you know. But then, as I say, Mick and Keith took it on, you know, to something even bigger, because Brian was into blues, really.
Why was it that, so early on, there's Nankerfelge as a name for group compositions. And I'm thinking Brian came up with that idea after they had, you guys.
That was Brian's idea, yeah.
Okay, after you guys had recorded Stoned. Later, you get a track in Another Land is on their Satanic Majesty's Request. In your opinion, why wasn't Brian able to write songs for the Stones? Why?
He was too shy and too afraid.
Really?
Well, you always are. Writing a song is very personal when you're really young. And you're always a bit worried that people are going to laugh about it, or, you know, if you write a song that's a bit romantic or something, you're a bit worried that people are going to laugh and poo-hoo it, you know, if you're in a rock band. And so it makes you very nervous. When I first did my solo albums in mid-70s, I knew that I didn't sing great, and it really embarrassed me. And when I did that one song on the Stones album, Satanic Majesties, I was so nervous about my voice that I put it through on a tremolo. Lola, another land. You know, because I was so embarrassed about it. But then, of course, you get a bit more confident once you've done it. Brian never did it. He never got over the embarrassment, so he never finished writing a song or anything. He had ideas, but he never took them forward. He was too shy. He was a bit afraid of what the rest of us might think about it, you know, and poo-hoo it or something. Brian was always very confident, but he was also very insecure.
Yeah.
And we all are in a way, you know. Charlie was. If there was another drummer coming, like Jim Keltner or someone like that, standing behind him, and when he's playing drums, he used to be so scared and so uptight about it, you know, thinking that they might not like what he was doing. And I used to feel the same if I'm playing bass, you know, and I've got, you know, these amazing bass players around listening to me, you know. You can't help that. It's part of being a musician, you know, because you always wanted to improve, but you're always knowing that there's other musicians out there that are so much better than you at what you do.
And yet, I guess with Brian, he did have a skill in the sessions with, as you mentioned, coming up with different instruments.
Well, you can pick up any instrument and find something to do. You just find anything, a flute, a harpsichord, a mandolin, just anything in the studio, because the studios used to have orchestras in there to do film work when we weren't always in there. And then we'd come in to do our sessions, and there was all the musicians' stuff in the side of the studio. So Brian used to go through it, you know, and find a Glockenspiel, a German little piano thing, you know, and take it out and put it on a track or something, you know. That's what he did, and he was able to do that. He could do anything, find a little wood flute, and he'd make a little melody out of it for a part of a song, and that was his magic, and he was a genius at that, you know. But then you had other genius people like Nicky Hopkins playing with you, and Billy Preston, you know, and people like that. So it was all accepted as normal. It was only when they were gone that you realised how much they were important to the band in those early days.
Do you have any thinking about him and his influences and his strengths? If he had managed to stay with the group, do you think that he would have developed into a songwriter, or that was just he never would have been able to stay any longer in the band than he did?
Well, he left because he wasn't really liking what we were doing anymore, you know. He was much more blues-oriented. He was more blues and R&B, which was R&B in those days. I'm not talking about what they call R&B now, which is completely different. I'm talking about rock and roll, R&B, a mixture between rock and roll and blues was R&B. That was Chuck Berry, that was Bo Diddley, that was all those people doing R&B. And Brian didn't ever want to leave those styles of music. So he got less and less happy in the band, I think that was the reason. So he was thinking of forming his own band when he left, a bit like Creedence Clearwater or something like that, you see, more R&B rocking, you know. And of course, it never happened, unfortunately.
Well, thinking about your own sort of musical development, how does like Les Paul's song, How High the Moon, Chuck Berry's appearance in the movie Rock, 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 and the bass player and the Barren Knights come together to sort of spur on your own?
I mean, it wasn't his playing. It was, I just heard the bass in a cinema ballroom. Suddenly heard the bass, and that really sort of inspired me that someone had to play bass in my little band. And it ended up being me, of course, because no one else wanted to do it. So that's the way things happen, you know, they're accidents. I mean, Chuck always wanted to play jazz. He ended up in a rock and roll band.
Yeah.
You know.
So I was reading, it's like the Les Paul song, How High the Moon, that is like your first sort of getting in tune with guitar sounds, or kind of identifying the guitar as a cool instrument, or?
I collected all Les Paul music, and I was the first Englishman to meet him, actually.
Oh, wow.
In 64 in America, and we became friends. And I was friends right throughout his life, actually. And I used to give his records to Jeff Beck and people like that who'd never heard him before. I'd introduce stuff and give them CDs of him and all that. Well, DVDs at that time. And, cassettes, music cassettes, or the Les Paul tracks and that, you know. He was lovely, and I've got one of his prototype guitars he gave me signed, you know, which is like a blessing. He came and saw the Rhythm Kings, and he absolutely loved us, you know, and he stayed for the two shows. And that sort of stuff. So we were very, very close. And he was a really, really close friend of mine.
The Chuck Berry, you saw him in the film Rock, Rock, Rock. And
yeah, that inspired me to buy Chuck Berry records, of course. But then I had to write away for them to America in those days and wait a month for them to come. I used to write to this record shop in Chicago because they weren't on sale in England.
And so I guess Chuck really, it's great that you were into Chuck, because that was pretty much your connection with the Stones when you first went in there and auditioned, right? I mean,
yeah.
Their love for Chuck.
Yeah, they were later than me, obviously. You know, I'd done military service. I'd heard rock and roll in American Forces Radio in Germany, where I was doing my military service in mid 55, 56, 57. And that's where I heard it before it came to England. So I was already writing away for Chuck Berry Records in 57, you know, whereas Mick and Keith and more like almost 1960 before they were interested in Chuck Berry, because they were younger than me, you know. So,
you know, I was reading the autobiography, and this thing where you were winning dance contests with the lady that became your first wife, Diane Corey. What were you dancing? This was
jiving. Yeah.
Well, jive. So, what is that? What sort of dance is that?
Jiving.
Jiving. Yeah. What is jiving?
It was another version, a later version of a jitterbug.
Oh wow. Okay.
They were doing in the '40s. You know, slinging over your heads, through your legs.
Yeah.
And all that, you know, spin, and all that kind of stuff. We used to win the competition, so we used to get free tickets for the next dance.
Well, that was kind of late in the 50s that you were doing that, right? Around 58, 59, so?
Yeah, exactly. Well, when I was a little boy, just at the end of the war, my aunt took me to a dance. I was 8 years old, and she took me to a dance where I saw a big band performing. All the people were dancing, and a lot of military people, American servicemen and Canadians, dancing with the English ladies and all that, and they were doing the jitterbug to this big band. And is when I first thought, I'm sitting there as an 8 year old watching this and thinking, it'd be nice to be in a band when I get older. but never imagined that it could possibly happen, obviously, you know. But that was my first moment of wanting to be in a band, really, and I was 8 years old.
The last thing I wanted to ask you was about Drive My Car. That's going to be our other track. We'll take a listen to that as we go out. Now, that one is credited solely to you.
Yeah, I wrote that, yeah. I wrote that about 4 years before I did the album. That's what inspired me to do the album. It just came out of the blue.
Ah.
As they do, you know, good songs usually just come out of the blue when you're not expecting them. And that did.
So no particular event inspired that? You weren't taking any road trip?
No, nothing, no. The lyrics just came out so easy, you know, and I was listening to country music and all that. And so I did it in that kind of flavor. And it worked very well.
And you've got the theme in there of not driving too fast.
Drive my car, but don't drive fast.
So Terry Taylor's on guitar. Paul Beavis is on the drums.
And Robbie McIntosh.
That's it. So tell me something about Robbie McIntosh. You mentioned him being a good guitar player.
He was on my previous album as well.
All right. And how did you come in contact with Robbie?
He's a very, very talented musician. Plays great slide and great acoustic and all that. He's used a lot by a lot of people. And he's excellent. So he did most of the solo work on it. Terry did most of the rhythm and the layouts of the other parts, you know.
Are there any plans to play out live any of these songs in the new year?
No, I don't play live anymore. Too old.
Yeah.
I've had enough of hotels where there's no heating, where room service is not there when you want it, where you can't get clothes washed. I mean, I've been through that with the Stones for 30 years and with the Rhythm Kings for 30 years or 20 years all over Europe and England and all that. It's enough. I don't want to do that anymore. I've got better things to do in my life now than stay in horrible hotels. And you have to, if you're traveling on the road, that you have to stay in hotels, and I just can't abide them anymore.
Well, I mean, if you're not doing music, you've got your photography or archaeology, you're writing on books.
I've got enough to do.
Right. Well, Bill, thank you so much for speaking with me today and making our coolest conversation so special.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
As promised, here's Drive My Car, title track to Bill Wyman's latest solo album in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Face in the mirror, looking like a fool. The power of the shower make me feel real cool. Dress looking real cute. If we ever get together, gotta buy a new suit. You can drive my car, but don't drive fast. Sitting in a diner, coffee and toast, finger licking chicken and down to the coast. I love the ocean, I love the sea. Breathing in the ozone's good for me. You can drive my car, but don't drive fast.
With some of Drive My Car, that's Bill Wyman and Little Steven's Underground Garage with the title track to his latest solo album. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks so much to Bill for making this such a special Coolest Conversations today. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza and Kurt Baker for producing and editing our podcast. Carla Olson first came to prominence back in the 1980s fronting the Textones, and since she's had a career that's led her to work with, record, and produce a number of greats, including Mick Taylor, Gene Clark, Eric Clapton, Ry Cooder, and a host of others. She's got a new single out now, Is It True? That's a cover of the Brenda Lee song, and on it she's backed by Tall Poppy Syndrome. She'll be my guest next time around to tell us all about it on your next Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.